You are listening to Powder Radio. Brought to you by Powder Magazine. Welcome to Sponsored, brought to you by Powder Magazine. I'm your host, Mike Powell, and this week on the program, we have Kim Reichhelm. She's been a pioneer in skiing for over 30 years, from her days on the U.S. ski team to the University of Colorado to her SkiWithKim.com business. Kim Reichhelm has made a difference in the world of skiing, and her story's an interesting one. We'll talk to her about the plake days, the race days, and everything in between. So hold tight and let's talk to Kim Reichhelm. Hello.
Hello. How's it going? Are you enjoying it?
I am. It's cool because I don't have a boss. And from the last time we've worked together, I was at K2. And towards the end, there was a lot of change going on there. And it was time for me to get out. And then I took a job with just a miserable person. They paid me well, but I was like, I just got to get away. And then I started this. It's been fun. And it lines up right with the people that I know and what I like to do. So how has your season been?
Good. Crazy. Actually, I worked a little too hard. I just decided to pack it in and work as hard as I possibly could. And it all worked out well. My camps were pretty full and things were great, but it just was overwhelming. I got kind of burnt out.
Burnt out with powder?
Well, just burnt out with clients and travel and hotel rooms. And I went 6 weeks straight of just one camp after another with the only days off were travel days. And you know how it is. You know, you can only go so hard for so long before you just die.
Yeah, it definitely wears on you. Just putting your laundry in the laundry machine and back in your suitcase and getting on another plane can be frustrating.
Exactly. For me too, it's so much my clients. Like my clients need, I need to be on. I need to have energy. I need to be inspired and inspire them. And if I'm fried, it doesn't work. They can tell.
Yeah, I mean, when you go on a trip with you, you're expecting one level of energy and a level of enthusiasm and fun because that's what you bring to the table every day when you're doing it for 70 days in a row. Is it hard to bring that to the table every day? I'm sure, but I know you probably make it happen.
For the most part, I really actually like it. Obviously, I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing if I didn't like it. So when I'm working, when I'm with my clients and I'm on and sharing their experience, I'm actually really happy. It's the making the gift bags and, you know, like the other day, I landed in Salt Lake. I flew to Grand Junction. I did laundry in some laundromat, went and got my nails done, drove to Montrose, spent the night in Montrose, drove to Telluride and did a welcome reception for 15 people and worked for 5 days straight.
And we're talking about Ski with Kim. If people want to find more information about it, it's at skiwithkim.com.
Yes.
And you've been doing that since 1989, along with a lot of other things. So it's been running for a long time.
It has. It's a finely oiled machine.
Yeah, I think when you put the blueprint together and you know what works, it's finding locations from there, getting the right clients and making sure you guys all mesh and making them fall in love with the skiing that you like to do.
Yeah, exactly. Group dynamics are key, especially for my smaller trips. My trips to places like Japan and Alaska and, you know, I'm just about to leave for Greenland. And the smaller trips, the group dynamics are really, really important. You know, I'd love to say yes to every single person, but when I put a trip together, I need to make sure that the group is going to gel not only with ski abilities, but personalities as well.
I would think one bad apple could ruin a whole trip for everyone.
Yeah, you can say so.
Cool. Well, I'm glad to have you on the show. In terms of women skiing, I don't think there's a better person that we can have. And just in terms of skiing, I don't even want to say women skiing, but you happen to be a woman in the ski world that's dominated by men. And you have always equaled or gone way above what the men have done in the ski world. I want to tell the story of how you got to where you are today. And I believe it starts back in Stratton. And it sounds like your parents were instrumental in opening the Stratton Mountain School.
They were. And I think that part of it was because they were just so sick and tired of me. I mean, I was just so obsessed with ski racing and all I wanted to do was be a ski racer and ski race all the time. And my parents just didn't know what to do with me. So they went to some of the other parents and said, you know, this is just not enough. This girl needs to ski more. She can't be living in Connecticut and coming up to Vermont every weekend and going to races. And I think for themselves too, they were just constantly driving us everywhere. So it was my parents and like three other parents that sort of got together and hired the teachers. The coaches already existed, but just created the environment where we were being tutored in two homes. And then there was like five or six of us that basically lived in our parents' homes and were tutored by teachers and then skied every day. And that was the beginning of Stratton Mountain School in the, you know, early 70s.
Wow. And so was that you, your two brothers, and maybe a handful of other students?
My brothers were not involved at all. I was a little bit ahead of the curve on my family as far as ski racing goes. There were some athletes that were just about to make the U.S. ski team. Abby Fisher at the time, Richie Woodworth, the Tarnelli family was very involved, and the Hellman family. All of those families had homes at Stratton, had kids that were ski racing. They were all older than me. All those kids were 2 years older than I was and just starting to make what the U.S. ski team at the time called the Talent Squad. And I was like 12. So I really wasn't anywhere near even ready to be doing something like that. But my parents, they couldn't control me.
And so did the family move from Connecticut to Vermont for the Stratton Mountain School?
No, we had a home at Stratton, as did the Tarnellis and the Hellman family. And so we used the homes as base, and then they hired teachers that were also like our house parents. And those people moved into our houses and lived there with us and cooked and cleaned and drove and taught us. And basically were tutoring us in the classwork. So we would get the syllabuses and all the work that our classes were doing back home and just keeping pace with the classes that we were going to if we had gone to normal school, taking the exact same tests, following exactly what this classroom was doing at home, but doing it in a different location.
Wow, it sounds like a way for your parents to get rid of you during the week at least.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, and get you to be a great skier while they didn't have to be a part of it. They funded it, of course, and created a school so they could do it. But yeah, they didn't have to deal with you as much. You know, it's interesting hearing that because in reading your whole story, it seems like a lot of your life has been trying to please your dad. And I think we'll talk about that as well. But you were always a big racer and you always had a chip on your shoulders. You were one of the best at what you did in any sport that you participated in when you were a kid. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, I was definitely an athlete first, for sure. I could run higher and jump farther than pretty much everybody all the time. And all of my confidence came from sports because I was a horrible student. I was dyslexic. I had difficulty reading. I really, really struggled in the classroom. And the playground was where all my confidence came from. And I was respected. I was picked as the first person on the team. I was often the one that chose the games that we play. And it was such a juxtaposition, so to speak, because I really struggled so much in school. I was such a bad reader when I was very young that I failed a reading comprehension class. And at that time, dyslexia wasn't something that the teachers and people really had a good handle on. And they took me out of reading class and put me in class with the mentally handicapped kids.
Huh.
So this is 63, 64, and so when reading class started, they would remove me from the classroom and go put me in a different classroom with handicapped kids. And all the kids in the classroom used to go, retard, retard. And I just think about how awful it was at that time. Being politically correct wasn't really something that existed. And I should have been traumatized by the whole experience.
That's what I'm thinking.
And when I look back, I kind of laugh at it. And it's pretty funny. But because I was such an athlete, because I had so much confidence on the playground that, you know, kind of made up for my lack of reading skills.
And did you play any other sports? Was there anything else going on other than skiing, or was that the primary focus?
I played everything, all team sports. I mean, pretty much anything that had anything to do with sports, I was in. So whatever it was, whether it was smear the queer in the backyard or competitions on the trampoline, I played softball, I played field hockey, I played soccer. I was an equestrian. My mother was a fabulous and still is a trainer and a fabulous teacher of hunter jumper type riders. And so when I was very young, I had a pony and we campaigned horses around the country and actually had a tremendous amount of success as an equestrian as well. And when I was just making the U.S. ski team, I had spent the entire summer actually traveling to compete in what's called the McClay Finals in Madison Square Garden. And I qualified and then the ski team invited me to Europe to train at the exact same time. And I think I was about 16. At that point, I chose ski racing over riding and quit riding and never really rode again after that.
Hmm. Did your parents have great jobs? Because it sounds like you had a house in Connecticut, a house at Stratton. You had a horse. You're traveling the country. And it sounds like they did pretty well.
My dad pretty much started with nothing and graduated from Dartmouth. He was very smart and also an athlete. And you know, he actually was very, very fortunate to have somebody help get him into college and through college financially. And then once he started working in Wall Street, he crushed it and became a member of the American Stock Exchange and was a trader, a specialist trader, and did extremely well. It's interesting. There are times where things wouldn't go so great and we'd be eating peanut butter and jelly at the base lodge and we wouldn't get new skis and nothing new, nothing special, you know, really buckling down. And then there are other times where my dad would have a great year and all those things came back. So there were definitely cycles, which I think was actually great for me as a kid because I did have some incredible opportunities and I did have a lot of nice things in my life, but there were times when I didn't. And I really recognized the difference and I understood that it wasn't always going to be that way, that there were times that it was going to be great and times that it weren't. I think that made me really appreciate the great things that I did have. And when my parents were able to be generous, it made me value it even more.
Yeah. So your dad did well. You make the U.S. ski team. You're around 16 years old and you're not going to go compete in equestrian and you're going to go to Europe with the U.S. team. And what are the years like on the U.S. team? And it seems like sometimes in your life you've had, I wouldn't say difficulty with authority, but maybe not seeing eye to eye with authority, and wondering if any of that had an impact on your time at the U.S. ski team.
Yeah, definitely. My family, we're very, very good communicators. Very open door policy in my house. There was always a lot of people around. There was always a lot of laughing and joking and brutal honesty. So I grew up with pretty thick skin. I grew up being able to take a hit, laugh at myself. There was no secrets in my house. And everybody got called out on bad behavior and doing stupid things. And there was no room in my family as a youngster for being sensitive or emotional when it came to superficial things. A lot of laughter, a lot of communication. So a fair amount of partying going on with my parents, as I remember as a kid, but all very healthy. But my dad is a bit of a ball buster.
Okay.
Because I did grow up in this environment where in the beginning, my dad, you know, you touched on it earlier, my dad really kind of ignored me when I was young. He's a bit of a chauvinist and really all the attention in the household went to my brother, Scott and Todd. And for me, he was like, don't you have some dishes to wash or some laundry to do or, you know, get out of the garage. Girls aren't allowed in the garage kind of thing. So it made me just want to be more with my dad and more like my dad. And all I wanted to do was mow the lawn and you know, fix the truck and siphon gas out of the car and everything that I wasn't allowed to do. So part of that was what made me more like my father, which is, you know, a hard ass ball buster.
Okay.
Not really a great way to be as a young teenager.
Right.
And not mature enough to recognize my behavior and how destructive it could be at times. I always thought things were funny when, you know, my girlfriends are crying and I'm laughing and telling them to toughen up a little bit. So there was that part of it. And then Stratton Mountain School was just a phenomenal ski academy. As I made the U.S. ski team and really developed as a ski racer in my early teens, you would sit down with your coach at the beginning of the season to discuss your year. What were the most important races? What were your goals? And how am I, as your coach, going to help you reach your fullest potential as an athlete? And if it's the U.S. Nationals that you want to make or the U.S. Nationals that you want to win, let's plan your season so you have enough training, enough time off, enough tools that you need to reach this goal. And I loved that. I loved working with the coaches. And part of the things that were great about that was that, one, I owned the decisions that I made. And if I slacked off, my coach would sit down and say, look, you know what? You made these choices. And we decided that this month you're going to bust your ass and you're going to work really hard. And then you're going to get a week off and then we're going to go on the road. And, you know, this is what we plan on doing. So what's the problem? And so there was always a lot of communication, a lot of support, and a lot of mutual respect between my coaches and myself in regards to my long-term plan and what I needed to do to make my goals.
Okay.
And I make the U.S. ski team, and it's the biggest clusterfuck I've ever been on in my life. It's just a complete junk show. The coaching staff was not strong. The organization was even worse. There was a tremendous amount of competition within the team itself, so there wasn't a lot of support there. So, you know, you travel to Europe, and there'd be 11 girls, and there's only slots for 10. So in between every race, we had to have time trials to see who was going to actually race in the race. And then you're traveling all over the world, and there's no dudes around. It's all girls. So I can't speak any other languages, so there's no opportunity for me to make other friends outside of the U.S. ski team. And then the girls that are on the U.S. ski team, I'm competing with for my slot for the next race. I mean, there was one time where we showed up in the wrong country at like midnight for a race that was the next day and had to drive all night long to get to the right town in France instead of Germany or whatever the hell it was. And there was just a constant lack of organization and poor coaching skills and not a lot of motivation and not a lot of support. And I struggled with it. You know, I was 15, almost 16 the first year I'd raced with the USQ team in Europe. So I was just very, very young and very immature. And I was used to having my brothers around, especially my older brother, Scott, at that time was very, very supportive of me and picked me up when I was down and gave me a hug when I was up. And I was used to being around a pack of pretty high-end ski racers that were all very supportive of one another. The ski team didn't have that, the camaraderie and solid leadership and organization and coaches that really, really cared about me and my future and my long-term plans didn't exist at all.
Sounds like you went backwards when you left Stratton Mountain School.
Oh, totally. And I have to say that I loved ski racing more than anything in the world. I mean, I lived for it. All I wanted to do was be in the Olympics and be a ski racer. And I make the U.S. ski team, and it's the first time and the only time in my life that I didn't love skiing. That's really sad for me. And because I didn't love it and I struggled with it, I wasn't certainly at my best as an athlete, and my focus was distracted. And when I look back, especially at what happened with me in my career as a skier, I was a little bit slow to mature, both physically and psychologically, and spiritually as well. When I look back, I wish that I had not blown it so badly with the ski team and been able to stay on, because I wasn't even close to my fullest potential before I had already gotten myself in so much trouble that the ski team wouldn't look at me.
What I heard was that there was a coach that wanted you to do the downhill. You didn't think the downhill was really made for you at that point in your body type, and you pretty much told that coach to fuck off?
Yeah, basically.
Okay. That does burn a bridge a lot of times. 9 out of 10 times that will burn a bridge.
Yeah. It was right before the U.S. Nationals were in Lake Placid the year before the 80 Olympics. And my goal for that year was to do well enough in the 1979 U.S. Nationals in Lake Placid to qualify for the Olympics the following year. And the ski team had decided that they wanted downhillers, that, you know, there was more attention for downhill. It would bring in more money to the ski team if we produced more downhillers, because it was the more flamboyant.
Okay.
Because at the time, there was only the three disciplines. Super G didn't exist.
Okay.
And there was no combined. You were the speed skier, you were a downhiller, or you were a technical skier, slalom and GS. My nickname in high school was Olive Oil. I mean, I was skinny and gangly, and I was a slalom skier, and I made the U.S. ski team as a slalom skier, and really hadn't developed as a young woman yet at all. I had had several friends that season have career-ending injuries running downhill that the ski team was forcing them to race in before they were ready. So we got to Mirabel, France, and I get handed a downhill suit and downhill skis, and I'm like, what's this? And they're like, you're running downhill. I said, no, I'm not. And they said, yes, you are. And I was just like, no, this isn't part of my plan. First of all, I'm afraid. I'm scared to death. I grew up in Vermont. I don't have any experience in downhill. This isn't where I want to spend my energy. My focus is continue to race Europa Cup, get home and race well in the U.S. Nationals. And that season as well, there were World Cups at Stratton on my home hill. My focus was to do well enough to race in the World Cups on the hill I had grown up on and skied my entire life.
I think that's a dream.
Yeah, exactly. And where a lot of U.S. athletes or any athlete, when you get your first chance to really compete in World Cup and start lowering your fist points, is on your home hill, in at least in your own country. That's where almost every ski racer really gets their first great results. And then from there, goes on to race World Cup, but has lowered their points, so they're not running in the 60s and 70s and that kind of thing.
Okay.
So the coach is like, you need to do this. This is the long-term plan for you, blah, 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 blah. And so I suck it up, and I'm like, okay, I'll do it. And this downhill, Mirabel downhill, was intense. It was like, you're going like 70 out of the start. It was insane. You went down this like luge track, and I was scared. And you know, anytime you're afraid, you're not safe.
Yeah, for sure.
So I take a fall. It's not a bad fall. The second training run, and I ski up to my coach in tears, and I say, please, please, please don't make me do this. I am scared to death. I'm afraid I'll get hurt. I'm not ready. Please don't make me run downhill. And he looked at me and he said, you are wearing a U.S. ski team uniform, and you'll do whatever we tell you to do, whether you like it or not.
Jesus.
So that was where the fuck you came out.
Yeah, really.
And I actually said, give me my plane ticket. I'm going home.
Good for you.
And I left. But by the time I got home, it took me like 3 days to get home. They put me in a van with the Italian team, and they took me to Innsbruck, and they had to get from Innsbruck to Munich, and all traveling with a ski bag of 6 pairs of skis in it and duffel bags. And it was insane when I look back at it how stubborn I was and focused on what was important to me. But by the time I got home, they had wired, Faxer, and the rest didn't really exist at that point. We're sending Reichhelm home because she's uncoachable.
Huh.
So I never got to really share my story or discuss what happened. It was pretty much over. And then, you know, I did very well in the U.S. Nationals. I was right in behind the A team and had great results at Lake Placid. And then they didn't let me race at Stratton, and they let girls race at Stratton who had never beaten me in their life.
Well, that has to be the most frustrating day of your entire life, I would think, at that point.
It was crushing. And then, you know, I continued to race and do very well. And then the following year, they announced the team for Lake Placid. And then the next team, the B team, was all a group of very young women. And I wasn't on the roster at all. And I called up and I said, you forgot about me. Like, you know, I was ranked 5th in the country in slalom, and I was not on the U.S. ski team at all. And they said, well, we've already picked our team for 1980, and you're not going to make it. And this is like June. The Olympics are in February.
Yeah.
And they said, you're not going to make the 80 Olympic team because we've already picked the squad, and you're going to be too old by 84, so you might as well go to college.
Did you say this is fucking bullshit, or did you just walk away?
I walked away because I didn't know how to fight it. At that same time period, Bill Johnson got kicked off the U.S. ski team as well. Their excuse for him was that he wasn't in good enough shape. Bill actually got a lawyer, and the lawyer went to the U.S. ski team and said, you can't do this. He's the best downhiller in the country. Just because you don't like him doesn't mean you can't keep him off the team.
Right.
And there was a lot of things that went on those days. There's a lot of athletes that were friends of mine and still are that did not like race in the Sarajevo Olympics in 84 because somebody on the ski team decided that they weren't going to win any medals, so they didn't deserve to race. So in 1984, we didn't fulfill our quota. So there's 4 athletes per discipline that are allowed to race in the Olympics. And there's a lot of athletes that qualified to race in the Olympics but were not allowed to race because the ski team said that they weren't going to win any medals, so they didn't deserve to race.
That is just so frustrating for people who put their entire life into something for some 60-year-old to make a decision that impacts them for the rest of their lives. It sucks. But that happens, I guess, all the time.
It does happen. And it's a lesson in life in many ways for me. I mean, so many lessons in that story that I still carry with me today. And, you know, I did go to college and I had a scholarship at CU and I learned so many valuable life lessons as well as getting an education when I was in school that in the big picture, I look at it and think, I don't know, I would like to think that I could have done it all, you know, could have raced in the Olympics, could have had a very successful career in the World Cup and done something very similar to what I'm doing today, because I think that's in me. But the ski racing part got cut short. And
yeah, it sounds like politics cut that short, which kind of sucks. Politics and a stubborn Kim Reichhelm.
Yeah. I mean, this stuff's been going on for a long time. Bodie got his own coach. Schlepper got her own coach. And a lot of athletes have left the ski team and gotten their own coaches and tried to go off on their own because they don't like the politics of the ski team and the way things are being run and a lot of the BS that you have to deal with in a supposedly nonprofit type organization.
Yep. I could go deep into that conversation, but I'm not going to. I'm going to focus more onto your schooling. And it sounds like you sometimes choose the harder route. It sounds like your dad, coming out of high school or when high school would end for you, said, hey, you can test the waters with the U.S. ski team. If it doesn't pan out, you're going to go to college. We'll pay for it. It's going to be on the East Coast. And you said when you got off the ski team, I'm actually going out west. Your dad didn't pay for it and you're able to get yourself a full ride. Was that kind of to throw it in his face or just to prove that you could do it? Or what was the thought process there?
Yeah, it was totally about throwing it in his face. I was not the greatest little teenager at times. And my dad can accept some of the responsibility because he made me that way.
Right.
I knew the coach at the University of Colorado had already offered me a full scholarship. And I knew I had that in my back pocket.
Okay.
And I didn't tell my parents. And I let them suffer. And I applied to CU as a normal student. I didn't apply to any other school. And I applied to CU without calling in my scholarship, and I got turned down because I was a terrible student.
Oh, yeah, you had mentioned that.
And So my dad was just livid, just yelling and screaming. And what are you going to do now? And you promised you would. There was just no way I was going to stay back east. I had been to Colorado enough times to know that I was actually born in the wrong place.
Okay.
I went to Boulder sight unseen. I'd never even stepped foot on the campus.
You just had to get west.
I had to get west, and I really wanted to be in Colorado over the other schools. I knew, you know, that I could get full rides at any one of the western schools that had a good ski team. When the coach at CU said, "You're in," I didn't bother with anybody else. And then after I got the letter of rejection from CU, I contacted the coach and then got an envelope in the mail within a week that offered me a scholarship. And of course, my dad was very, very happy, but still quite pissed off at me for yanking his chain.
When you went off to Colorado at that point, did you ever move back home, or is that when you really started your life and started blazing the trail of Ski with Kim and all the different things you did?
Pretty much. My freshman year, I blew out my ankle actually training for skiing. I had sprained my ankle several times and then ended up completely tearing it, running, stepping on a rock, running in the foothills or something like that. And so I had to have surgery once school was out, and I had it in Denver. So I did go home that first summer and recover from my ankle surgery. But that was it. So the first summer as a freshman, I went home. But after that, I pretty much stayed in the West. And I ended up, once my 4 years of school were up, I still had another semester and I got in-state tuition so that I was able to save some money and finish school and get out of there. But yeah, I just loved Colorado and loved living there. You know, I still love Connecticut. I go back and visit my family every year, and I'm very close to my entire family. So Connecticut's great and Vermont's great. Although I don't know if I've skied Stratton in 30 years.
Yeah, well, you're not missing that much because you've been skiing a lot of other places that are pretty phenomenal. I should say that you went to college in the 70s because you probably won't like me to say that. And you finish and then go straight on to the Pro Tour. And what's the Pro Tour like? Is there any money to be made? And what's the vibe like for you at that point?
You know, I'm really lucky, Mike, at that time. The pro ski racing was pretty much at its heyday when I graduated from college. And I knew that I was going to race pro. Actually, I went to a Bobby Addy World Pro Ski Race when I was 9 years old. And it was at Mount Snow, Vermont. And I was in awe with the whole scene. Spider and Henri Duvillard and Billy Kidd. And the spectacle of ski racing was a show. I remember saying to my coach, after the Olympics, I'm going to race professionally. And he said, there is no pro ski racing for women. And I looked right at him and I said, there will be. Somehow I knew deep down that there would be pro ski racing for me once I was ready. And it was really at its heyday when I graduated. So I studied like basically how to be sponsored and how to be a good spokesperson. And, you know, I studied sports marketing in college. I did all my research, all my papers. I mean, I got credit in college for negotiating my pro contract. I interned with Head Reich the Tyrolia. I traveled around with sales reps. I went to Vegas every year. I was really tapped into making money as a professional skier while I was in school, knowing that was the next step. So I was probably more prepared than any ski racer that went to pro ski racing. You know, I had a resume, I had a portfolio. I had gone to Denver and taken an acting class at JF Images so that I would have good interviews and good camera presence. So as a rookie on the Pro Tour, I really hit the ground running and was able to make a lot of money. If you podiumed, you were looking at between $800 and $1,500 as a check, prize money check.
Okay.
And then you double it or triple it if you had good sponsors and you were doing a good job representing the companies and you had good contracts. So my contracts paid heavily for every time I was on TV. All of those races were covered by ESPN at the time. So this is 84, 85, 86.
Okay.
Every contest was on TV. So all I had to do was get my mug in front of TV with my head skis in the shot, and I was making bank.
Huh.
By the end of my rookie season, I got a bonus check of like $15,000.
Dang. And that's a lot of money. I mean, we're talking 86. So that's a shit ton of money.
Yeah, a lot. And I'll tell you, the acting class was the best thing I'd ever done because I understood what my job was on TV was to, you know, speak articulately about something that the viewer could understand and relate to. So my sound bites were so good that they ended up interviewing me at every single race. Whether I podiumed or not, I was always on the TV show because they knew that they could get something articulate and thought out that would be good for the show.
as you move on, you spend 3 years on the tour, and it sounds like as long as your mug's on TV, you're getting paid. And then you eventually become a commentator that puts your mug on TV a whole lot more. Was that part of the decision to commentate, was to get more TV time and get paid more?
For sure. It was interesting because Anheuser-Busch was the main sponsor of the Pro Tour. So, you know, I studied it. What are your goals? What are you getting? Why are you sponsoring this tour? What are you looking for? And what I realized was all they wanted to do was entertain their accounts. So if the race was in New Hampshire, then they would bring in the distributor, the Anheuser distributor from that area, and they would bring in all their VIPs, all their best distributors, and it would be 15 dudes hanging out who want to watch a bunch of girls ski race. Before the race, I would get a list. What are the names of every single person from Anheuser-Busch, and what are their jobs and how important? Who are they? And then I would dress nicely and I would introduce myself and I'd give out my business card and I would go to bars and do my job as a representative of Anheuser-Busch. So Anheuser-Busch loved me. I always got to sit at the head table. I always got to rub elbows with the most important people. I always had a Michelob Light in my hand. Whether I was drinking it or not, I understood that my job as a pro racer was to promote, sell, and entertain people from Anheuser-Busch.
Yep.
So from that, there was a promotion called Busch City Ski, where Anheuser-Busch would go to these locations all over the cities. I mean, we did these things during spring break in Miami and Daytona Beach and cities all over the place where we'd line the streets or build a 30-foot scaffolding ramp and then line the beach with hay bales and bring in 250 tons of crushed ice and create these makeshift ski runs in cities all over the country. And so Anheuser-Busch hired me to be the spokesperson for Busch. So I would go to these events and do all the interviews with the media and make a little spectacle run down this 30-foot ramp. And I mean, it was all kind of crazy, but we had the Hawaiian Tropic girls skiing around in bikinis and, you know, spring break type craze silliness.
Did you ever feel awkward being the spokesperson for Busch?
Absolutely not.
Okay. I think it would be an honor, actually.
Yeah. Anheuser-Busch went on and was sponsored me. Budweiser was my sponsor when I was competing in the Big Mountain Tour. All that. So they've stayed with me. There was a sponsor of Women's Ski Adventures for a long time. So I built great relationships with them. And, you know, I've always been a bit of a partier. So having a beer in my hand was not really a problem.
You definitely have always liked to have a good time and you make sure everybody's having a good time around you.
So what happened was I was working for Anheuser-Busch doing these Busch City skis and still racing on the Pro Tour. And I wasn't really training very much, but I was making lot more money doing Busch City Ski than I was racing on the tour.
Okay.
After my third year, I was rookie of the year. Then I think I was third on the pro tour and I really wanted to win the tour. And then on the third year, I think I ended up sixth. And so it was a step back and I had to sort of take a look at it and say, all right, I'm either going to win the tour or I'm going to quit. I wanted to win. And then I realized that in order to win the tour, I was going to have to drink less beer and focus more on ski racing and not traveling around to Miami Beach in between ski races. So I decided to stop racing, and then they immediately handed me the job to be a part of the broadcast team.
So then you could really ramp up your partying when you're able to stop racing. And that's important. I mean, skiing is not all about going fast.
No, it's really not. That's not where the money is anyway.
So you do the broadcast thing, you're doing that for a couple of years, and you get the itch to go back and ski again. I think you're in Squaw Valley, you hit the KT chair, and you realize, hey, I am not really all about being a desk jockey behind a microphone. I'm about that action, as Marshawn Lynch would say. And what happens?
You know, for the first time in my life, I didn't have ski racing as a motivation. You know, usually for the last whatever it was, 20 years practically, I get off the lift and I ski down to the course and I run the race course. And I train and I focus and I work out and all my energy was towards being the best ski racer I could be. And when I stopped ski racing on the Pro Tour, it was the first time that I didn't have that motivation. And I do remember riding up the lift to KT going, what am I going to do? Like, I need to challenge myself all the time in all aspects of my life. I like challenges. I like taking on new things. So it just kind of naturally started pushing my own skiing ability, like looking for more challenging terrain, steeper lines. All of a sudden, I'm no longer looking for the best groomer and the gates, but I'm looking for something that's going to give me a rush and push me as a skier. So I'm at Squaw, and I'm starting to ski some lines off of KT and, you know, just kind of having fun learning how to ski more challenging, steeper lines. as I move my way around the mountain, I just see this pack of skiers that are clearly the best skiers on the mountain. And they knew where to go, and I didn't really know where to go. So I kept positioning myself so that I'd be getting on the lift at the same time they would.
Okay.
Finally, after the third run, I got somebody to ride up with me. And I started asking questions. Where were they going? Were they skiing? And I'm still in sort of racing clothes, and I'm on racing skis. And the dude on the lift is sort of checking me out. He's sizing me up, you know, on my equipment and whatnot. And I asked him if I could ski with him. And we get up to the top, and he goes, "Hey, guys, this chick wants to know if she can take a run with us. She used to race on the Pro Tour, and now she's here working for Anheuser-Busch." And so they agreed to let me tag along, and kind of the rest is history.
Yeah, and it sounds like from that decision or from that run, from there on out, that's how your career moved for the next 10 to 15 years. You were involved in putting together World Extreme organizations. You were a two-time World Extreme champion. I think you got to know McConkie very well and worked with him on a lot of things. And as we kind of round out the later half of your career, tell me about the, I will call it the extreme days, when you started getting off the groomed fast runs.
I was kind of lucky in those days. So I'm working for Anheuser-Busch, and I'm just skiing my brains out and having a blast. Naturally, in changing the way I ski and the kind of terrain that I ski. And I was again in Squaw Valley the following year, late 80s. It was 87, because I think that's the year they shot Blizzard of Oz.
Mm-hmm.
And I was good friends with Bruce Benedict, who is a cinematographer for Greg Stump. And I had worked with Bruce over the years just doing regular still ski modeling type stuff. So Bruce contacted me. He's like, "Hey, we're in Squaw. I'm shooting some film. Why don't you come up and hang out with us?" And Bruce always knew that I was a really good skier and wanted me to meet Greg Stump. And I didn't know it at the time. But so I went up to Squaw and basically skied with those guys while they were filming License to Thrill. And Bruce shot some footage of me, which was not intended for the film, but for Greg to watch me ski. And then Blizzard of Oz came out. And then the following year, Stump asked me to ski with them to shoot License to Thrill. And so that was sort of how I transitioned into films. And then it was through being in License to Thrill that I was invited to go to Alaska to compete in the first World Extreme Skiing Championships. And I mean, honestly, I got the phone call from a guy named Mike Kozad and said, "Hey, I'm Mike. I live in Alaska and I own this lodge with a helicopter. And we're going to run a contest called the World Extreme Skiing Championships. And the entry fee is $500 and we'll cover 3 days of heli skiing and your lodging and all your meals. Do you want to come?" And I'm like, "Yeah." I mean, I don't say no very often because, you know, I like adventures and new stuff and taking things on. And you never know what you're going to experience if you say no. And so I was all in and said yes. And it's probably one of the best decisions I made because it was a life-changing experience to fly up to Valdez and to ski those mountains and to be with Coombs and Conway and Cummings and some of the guys that were pioneers in the whole big mountain movement. I mean, even McConkie was still trying to graduate from college at the time. So it was an older crew of people that had a lot of experience. A lot of Alaskans the first year were up there. But the cool part was that none of us knew what we were getting into, and we were all just open to the idea of doing something different and skiing someplace new. There weren't any photographers there. There was no filming. There was no prize money. There was no recognition. It was like a festival. It was just a ski festival.
Sounds like the good old days.
It was amazing. I mean, none of us were wearing helmets. None of it had been skied. None of the runs had been named. Yeah, and it was just amazing, amazing experience. And I really didn't have any experience at all. Never even worn a beacon, never been in a helicopter. But I did attach myself to the smartest people. I just made sure that I was always hanging out with the snow safety director. You know, I knew that if I was close to Doug Coombs that I was in a safe place.
Right, right.
I really paid attention and listened and aligned myself with the most knowledgeable people from a big mountain snow safety, overall safety standpoint. And those are the people that I learned from.
That is awesome. We got through a lot of your career in a lot of depth, and hopefully we'll talk again and get through the extreme days in a lot of depth. But your career from the race days to when you went to Alaska and got into Alaska for the first time, your career has always been progressing and doing something better that is not only great for skiing, but is great for Kim Reichelm. You've gone on the best trips. You've had the best times. And I can only imagine that part of the struggle of your life was trying to please your dad, but everything other than that really ended up working out for you. I mean, you put yourself in position to do exactly what you wanted to with your life, and Ski with Kim is the icing on the cake, a business that's been going on since 89 that allows you to ski all over the world, and it's been a pleasure to watch the snippets of your career that I've seen, and I thank you for coming on the show.
Thanks, pal. I appreciate it. It was, you know, we didn't touch on any of the K2 stuff, but working with K2 has also been an amazing part of my career. I love working with the engineers and designing skis, and having worked with you and having you a part of that K2 team as well. Those were some really fun days.
The only reason I really didn't touch on K2 is because I've had like 40 people on the show and everybody's K2, and I get some comments right about too much of that. So thanks for your time, Kim, and we'll talk to you soon.
Okay.
So that was Kim Reichelm, and she is an awesome story. She's one of those people that when you run into her on the road, you know you're guaranteed to have a good time, because she is always coming with energy. She's always the life of the party, and that's why people keep coming back to her Ski with Kim adventures. Next Monday on thepowelmovement.com, I have Kevin English, and he is the owner of High Cascade Snowboard Camp. It's one of the oldest, most respected snowboard camps out there over at Government Camp in Hood. And we will talk to Kevin about why he got out of the brand game and decided to buy into the camp game, and what he sees the future of summer camps within the snowboard industry. So that's next week on thepowelmovement.com. As always, if you have any show feedback for me, you can reach me at mike@thepowelmovement.com or on Twitter @PowelMovement1. I want to thank you for listening, and I will talk to you next week.